Welcome, everyone, to the 999th session of the Dallas Philosophy Forum. Oh, I'm glad everybody's awake. I want to know how many sessions we've had through all the years. Anyway, glad you could make it. We have a little bit of a few announcements to make. First of all, the board is looking for a volunteer to cart our PA equipment. So if anyone is interested in volunteering to the forum, notify me after the meeting or any other board member, Jack Duncan, Ken Sauber, Lawrence Bioki. Also, we do have a $5 per evening fee. And how much is our 6 month membership?
$35.
And for six months, $35, you can come every day for 6 months. Anyway, okay, I'm going to go ahead and lead an introduction to our speaker, Daniel Cundiff, who has so graciously come here all the way from a cattle ranch in North Texas, drove 2.5 hours to get here in traffic. He received his BA in Philosophy and Religious Studies at the University of North Texas. He then proceeded to advanced studies at the University of Dallas, where he obtained his MA in philosophy. He's currently in the PhD program at the University of Dallas and working on his dissertation, which is focusing on Plato's Symposium. Without further ado from me, please help me welcome Daniel Cundiff.
Hi. Well, she said, my name is Daniel Cundiff, and I'm going to be talking about Aristophanes' speech in the Symposium and Catullus's, the Latin poet, or Roman poet Catullus, his poem 101. So, okay. The charm of Aristophanes' speech in the Symposium cannot be denied. Part of that charm consists in the poet's, Aristophanes is a comic poet, the poet's giving us a vision of love so true to human experience. Many people have had the fortune or misfortune to experience the faithfulness of love, that innocent experience of love which lies behind such utterances as "you are the one for me" or "she is my better half." However, we must beware of being so charmed that we forget to examine and bring reason to bear on Aristophanes' speech. As Socrates makes clear in the beginning of his apology, the persuasive speech is not necessarily the true speech. While the charm of Aristophanes' speech may be undeniable, the need to examine its truth is equally undeniable. The following lecture divides into four parts of an equal length. The first part presents some general observations about the Symposium and its relationship to other Platonic dialogues. These general observations point to the importance of Aristophanes as a character in this dialogue. And so the second part addresses the issue of Aristophanes' importance. The third and fourth parts present an interpretation of Aristophanes' speech and an interpretation of Catullus 101 in light of the interpretation of Aristophanes' speech. Okay. The significance of Plato's Symposium within the body of Platonic writings becomes clearer if one keeps in mind Socrates' popular presentation of himself in the Apology. The Apology can be said to be his most popular because it is his conversation, sort of, with the people, or with the city of Athens. So we learn from the Apology that the Athenians accuse Socrates of not believing in the gods of the city and of corrupting the young. Socrates attempts to allay the impiety charge, not believing in the gods of the city, by presenting his way of life as commanded by the god of Delphi. Since Socrates nowhere else in the dialogues bases his philosophic activity on the Delphic injunction, we are rightfully suspicious of this line of defense. We are goaded by this suspicion to question what exactly Socrates' views of the gods of the city are. Was Socrates ultimately guilty as charged? The Symposium is the only Platonic dialogue whose theme is the praise of a god, who is generally accepted as a god, Eros or Cupid, whichever one you want. That Eros is generally accepted as a god is clear from the beginning of the Symposium. Eryximachus, one of the participants, proposes a series of speeches in praise of Eros in response to his friend's complaint, Phaedrus, frequent complaint, that neither poet nor prose author have ever adequately praised the god. If Eros were not generally recognized as a god, Phaedrus' complaint and annoyance would be nonsensical. Therefore, the Symposium is the only Platonic dialogue devoted to the praise of a god, a generally accepted god. This point must be stressed, because in the end, Socrates, or Socrates through Diotima, will deny that Eros is a god. The Symposium, then, is the only dialogue where Socrates openly denies the divinity of a being that is generally accepted as a god. Our suspicion of Socrates' guilt is growing. One may keep in mind, also, I mean, just in this relation, Richard Hunter, in a recent book on the Symposium, which I'm not necessarily particularly a fan of, but he, in the beginning of his interpretation of the Symposium, goes through all these various things that are said about Symposia, and what is supposed to go on in Symposia. The one thing he fails to do, though, is to look at the role of Symposia in Plato. He fails to look at the role of Symposia or the discussion of Symposia in Book 1 of Plato's Laws, where Symposia are directly connected to a sort of loosening, a certain freedom of speech is present there, and not only that, of questioning law. Because, of course, Socrates in the Laws is talking with a Spartan, Megalos, and a Cretan, Clinias, and, of course, Symposia are illegal in Sparta. Well, at least Sparta, then. I don't know if they are now. Okay, so, in the Apology, Socrates places Aristophanes in the camp of his first accusers. In his great comedy, The Clouds, Aristophanes portrays Socrates as emphatically denying the existence of Zeus. Are you saying you can't hear me? Do you need me to speak? Oh, okay. Sorry. So in The Clouds, Socrates is accused, basically, or is presented as denying that Zeus is, and ultimately of replacing the Olympian gods with the clouds, the goddesses, the clouds. It is interesting, when Socrates in the Apology lists the things that are alleged against him in the clouds, he leaves that one out. That he is a student of nature, he puts that in. That he makes the weaker speech the stronger, he leaves that in. But that he denies the existence of Zeus, he very nicely leaves out but in any event, and so you can see there, Aristophanes, as his perhaps greatest accuser, his importance at the Symposium, and of course this is the only time Aristophanes appears. And you can ultimately say, of the renowned Greek poets, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, and Aristophanes, I mean, he is the only renowned poet to appear in all of Plato's. There's never a dialogue between Socrates and Aeschylus. There's never a dialogue between Sophocles and Socrates. There's never a dialogue between Socrates and Euripides. Aristophanes is the only eminent Greek poet that he is represented in the dialogue with. And so, okay. So in the Symposium, you can say that Socrates meets his accuser face to face. Okay. Now, in addition to that, there are other things that point to the significance. At the beginning of the symposium, it is agreed by Agathon, or at least stated by Agathon, that he and Socrates will go to court over their respective wisdoms, poetic wisdom and philosophic wisdom. They will go to court with Dionysus as judge. Of course, this is a sort of weak reference to Aristophanes' Frogs, where there is a contest between the old tragic poet Aeschylus and the new tragic poet Euripides, and the judge is Dionysus. And of course, Aeschylus wins that. But ultimately, what it hinges on is, Dionysus' judgment between Aeschylus and Euripides hinges on how they view Alcibiades. And of course, Alcibiades comes in at the very end of the symposium. He's drunk, and he is the one ultimately that gives the wreath to Agathon. But then goes on to give a praise of Socrates. So there's that, and so his presence there, the sort of vague references to Aristophanes' plays, all go to show the importance and really the centrality of Aristophanes for this symposium. Okay. One of the things, the general things that I want to mention about the symposium in general is its liberality. Everything is open. It's free. The door is open. Socrates, when he arrives at Agathon's house, the door is open. Everything's free. Even Agathon, in relation to his servants, is quite free. He doesn't stipulate what they are to cook, how they are to serve. And then, in point of fact, encourages them to treat him as if he had been invited by his servant. And so there's a great air of freedom. It's also important to notice that everybody, say, Aristophanes, and, to some degree, Alcibiades, they're when they're a student of the Sophists, except Socrates and Aristophanes. Phaedrus is a student of the Sophists. Erasmus is a student of the Sophists. They're both students of the Sophists. I believe Hippias, but it could be Prodicus. But everyone's there. Pausanias and Agathon also are students of Sophists. So you can, in some sense, say that all of the Athenian intellectuals are here, and they are all Athenian, which is not always the case when you first get on the dialogue. And so, okay, with that in mind, I will turn now specifically to Aristophanes. On the most general level, Aristophanes' speech divides into two parts. The first part presents the original nature of man, and the second covers civilized man, or man as we know him after the process of civilization by the Olympian god, or his taming by the Olympian god. In a certain sense, one can say that Aristophanes presents an original state and a subsequent fall, but one should not confuse this with the Catholic understanding of a fall. Beyond any other, his speech is revolutionary. When I say revolutionary, I mean his speech has as its aim a novel teaching or innovation. Human beings thus far, according to Aristophanes, human beings thus far have not adequately perceived the power of eros. Okay, so that's typically translated love, but because of the way that the English word love is used in sort of, you cannot really say in Greek, I have eros for French fries, whereas in English you can say I love French fries. And so it is passionate love, something like that. And it's most basic, passionate love. have not adequately perceived the power of Eros' law. On what does Aristophanes base this judgment? If human beings, according to Aristophanes, if human beings did adequately perceive his power, Eros' cult, or his worship, would be far greater. Aristophanes agrees, in a way, with an earlier speaker, Phaedrus, that Eros is not sufficiently honored. Since human beings are generally ignorant of Eros power, somebody must teach him about his power in order to effect a change, to bring about adequate honor of him. There must be a change. He will initiate this small group in the symposium into the doctrine, and then they, in turn, will initiate others. Before he can initiate us into the power of this God, he must first teach us about original human nature. Original man, or the original kinds of man, differed from civilized man in shape, strength, and motion. Originally, there were three sexes instead of two, male, female, and androgynous, which is male, woman, gynae, woman, andro, or aneo, man. original man was spherical in shape, with four arms, four legs, and two faces on a single head positioned on a cylindrical neck. There was, and the faces, so one on one side, one on the other, they are opposite to each other, so they do not see each other. Now, this leads to that conclusion. Now, we did not originally walk upright, but tumbled. To move slowly, we tumbled. To move quickly, we would raise ourselves on these eight limbs and go in circles, quickly, in a circle. Original man shared the shape and motion of his parents, sun, earth, and moon. So males came from the sun, females from the earth, and then the androgynous from the moon. As you can see, original man does not derive his form from the Olympian gods, but rather from the cosmic gods of itself. So these would be what in Hesiod's Theogony, these would be the primary, the original beings, earth and sky, something like that. And then there are apparently two attributes that distinguish original man from his parents. He had incredible strength and high thoughts. Ta phronemata megala, high phronemata, high thoughts. Phronemata is the product of your frame, which is roughly calling the word brain. I mean, they sound, you also get diaphragm. In any event, I wanted to point this out to you. The phrase high thought occurs earlier in the symposium, in a speech by Pausanias, and it is used in with the issue of pederasty, what we don't really have a word for, but pederasty, it is something that is prohibited by tyrants because it can give rise to high thoughts. And so if the high thoughts are in some sense connected with freedom, or lack of subservience, or an unwillingness to be subverted. Now, Aristophanes' myth becomes very obscure at this point. Original man, in contradistinction to his parents, was always subservient to the Olympians. The Olympians are just there. He doesn't give any account of their origin. And original man was apparently subservient to them from the very beginning. They did not conquer him. It simply was all right. But at some point in time, they had these high thoughts and make an attempt desire to make an attempt on the Olympians. Now, at this point, ultimately in the myth, Zeus calls together the rest of the Olympians and they have counsel. Because Zeus does not know what to do. Zeus is not an omniscient being. And finally, they're at a loss, and there are two problems that Zeus is trying to deal with. And it's one, they cannot kill them because if they kill them, they will disappear, and so will the honors given to the gods will disappear. The gods are, and this is another theme of course, Aristophanes' play, The Birds. And this occurs in other Aristophanes' plays where the human beings starve the gods by not giving them sacrifices. So this sort of issue of the gods' dependence on human beings. So that's the first problem. They can't just kill them. And the second problem is they cannot allow them to be licentious. That's it. And so Zeus thinks... what? So Zeus thinks and thinks and thinks and comes up with his solution, which is to divide them, to split them. And so that's what he does. He splits them. It's described as a store of apples or eggs, dividing eggs with a hair. And so he divides them. But there's a problem. They want to get back together. And they try to get back together. And they do get back together. And it's funny, I suppose, in English. It is incredibly sad in Greek, for some reason, because of the verbs that he's using. He uses a verb for entwining. They entwine together and try to enthoon, or sun, to grow back together. They're trying to grow back together. That is to say, they are ultimately trying to become whole or complete again. In any event, so inevitably they latch on to each other, and they won't let go of each other. Well, they start to die, right? I mean, they start dying, and this is not what Zeus wanted. They're dying, and so Zeus has Apollo rearrange the parts of their body, and we are then fully in the form of the Olympian gods. We are in their image, and they can, of course, their genitals have been rearranged, and they can reproduce ultimately. And so that fixes, it's a boon for Zeus. Not only does it enable them to have achieved some level of satisfaction and go about doing other things other than just simply embracing, but it also multiplies worshippers for Zeus. And so, to try to pull all of this down, wise, again, you would have to, in some sense, look at what he's saying. Of course, it's a myth. He's a comic poet, but it's funny. I mean, to a certain degree, it is. But, and it's like with the story of, say, Oedipus Rex. It is a myth, but it is a myth from which you are supposed to draw a real conclusion, or a non-mythical conclusion. And this is that, in some sense, that eros, or that love, is a conjunctive principle. It joins or brings together or makes whole. Right? And that is ultimately the sort of love. And so ultimately he grounds love in the embrace, in the attempt to be one, to achieve union. However, it's impossible. It's impossible on the one hand, because they've died. And so, getting back to the original whole is not possible. The only thing that can approximate it is if Hephaestus, the god Hephaestus, I could melt you two, I could melt you back together, but that wouldn't do either. Because, of course, they have been completely rearranged. And so, it is that power of Eros to sort of convince you that whatever it is that Eros is directed for will complete you, but the ultimate impossibility of that. And so the comic poet, Aristophanes, presents you with an incredibly, incredibly tragic Eros. An Eros that can never be fulfilled at all. It simply can't be. But this, that's the one side of it. What Eros does do in Aristophanes' speech is it does try to bring you back to your original nature. But what does the original nature mean? Rebellion against the gods. I mean, that's what, I mean, or the attempt to thwart the gods. That's what the original nature means. There will always be a tension between Eros, or law, and law, which is maintained and supported by the divine, and divine punishments, divine punishments. So Eros will always be in tension with the gods. And it's ultimately to show this. For instance, if you will think of this in terms of Thomas Hobbes' state of nature teaching. In the state of nature, sure, you have no civil society or its woes. But you also have no art, no music, no iPhone, no. And so that is the whole thing. Man becomes civilized or cultivated under the hands of the Olympian gods, but at the same time, there is this element of rebellion against them and against civilization. However, he needs both in some sense. In a certain way, he needs both. And they do not happily go together at all. Now, it is this exact point that brings me to Catullus. And I will simply, it's a very short poem. It's Catullus's 101. And I'll simply read it to you. I may change a word or two, but this is basically Cornish's translation. And it's a fine translation of it, but it's a little old. So the poem goes like this. This is a prose. Wandering through many countries, having wandered through many countries, I don't like that, many peoples, having wandered through many peoples and over many seas, I come, my brother, to these sorrowful funeral rites, to present you with the last guerdon honor of death, and speak, though in vain, to your silent ashes. Since fortune has taken your own self away from me. Alas, my brother, so cruelly torn from me. Yet now, not else availing, take these offerings, which by the custom of our fathers have been handed down, a sorrowful tribute for a funeral sacrifice. Take them, wet with many tears of a brother, and forever, O my brother, hail and farewell. Okay, so this is an elegy. And so, right, it's a song for her. And it's composed in elegiac couplet. But what is interesting about it is, one, there is no consolation in what is handed down from his parents. There is no consolation he receives in these activities. In point of fact, he states very clearly, I'm here talking to something that can't hear me. But what is really, really, what's really stands out about it is the utterance at the very, in the very center. Fortune has taken your own self away from me. Alas, my brother, so cruelly torn from me. Fortuna, right? Fortuna is another word, and of course, if you look at it, how it's used in, say, Machiavelli, it's another word for nature. Nature took or fortune. Notice, I mean, his brother, the brother has died in a battle. He's not angry with the enemy. He's angry at fortune or nature. Nature is unconcerned with human emotions. You will die, and you will suffer a loss, or respect it, doesn't bother fortune. This is what incites you to abandon fortune or nature as a standard by which to judge right and wrong conduct, because it is at odds with human feelings or emotions or passions or whatever. All of those things in some sense that make human life forbidding. Okay, and that's basically this sort of bifurcation in man. Because, I mean, oftentimes, even now, in sort of talk about nature and whatnot, it is forgotten that man is a natural being as well. Man is a part, is just as much a part of nature as a tree. I mean, he's not a product of himself in the decisive respect. And so, this sort of splittedness, ultimately, a tragic view of human existence. Okay, that's it. Aristophanes and Catullus. There you go.
Okay, now we'll have our question and answer time as usual. Please keep it to a question, not a commentary or dissertation of your own. Anyone like to start? Kick it off with a question for Mr. Kondo. Everybody knows everything about Eros? Bob, you're not even going to say anything? Bob? Okay.
Well, Professor, what do you know? You never mentioned anything about agape?
About what?
No, agape. No, Eros, agape.
Okay, agape, yeah.
Is that a form of love? Or could you, is there any connection between the two?
Not in terms of symposium. Agape is mostly associated with the New Testament and the relationship between fellow Christians. That's not what he's talking about here. He is talking about that there are three different words, common words in Greek for that are typically translated love. Eros, which is passionate love, and is most innocently sort of connected with sex. Then there's philos, or philia, which is typically friendly, friendship. And then agape, which is something like fondness, brotherly affection, something like that. You could be said to have agape for your parents, for your siblings. You could be said to have philia for your siblings. If you're said to have eros, you've got problems. At least from the point of view of Sophocles, Oedipus Rex, you've got problems if you have that. And so they're not, they do have a way of encroaching on each other's terms, but agape is one that really does start to appear more so in the New Testament, in New Testament Greek.
Two questions.
Yes.
Was Plato have a big tongue-in-cheek by presenting this obviously ridiculous mythology in the mouths of Aristophanes? Was he poking fun at Aristophanes?
Well, you do need to remember
the stupid, you know, kind of mythology thing of eight arms and legs and arrows, putting it mixed together. Obviously, sex was known from animals. I mean, you know,
obviously, what was known?
Sex.
Okay.
Arrows.
No. I don't think Plato would ever say that there's anything like eros in animals.
The other question was, before you, is Catullus a stoic? Because, you know, no emotions.
No. Catullus is usually grouped with Virgil as being Epicurean. But on the issue of Eros, it's specifically in relationship to the reason why you can not say, in the case of human erotic things require sight, and they require beauty. You won't just sleep with just anyone. The bull does not care what the cow looks like. And so human eros is different from animal sexuality, for Plato.
So you're saying that eros here is being used as the unifying principle of man alone. So
yeah, because he's the only one that's split.
Okay, so is he attributing, is Plato attributing that to his nature, to man's nature? Is it something extraneous that's actually... He doesn't seem to attribute it to the divine.
Right, exactly. Right, and see, that's kind of the funny thing, is that Aristophanes, throughout his comedies, of course, he's a consummate conservative. Mm-hmm. He's a reactionary, and and of course, he was loved by Nietzsche, and Nietzsche was no fan of democracy. And was no fan of liberalism in general. But in any event, here, Plato has the accuser of Socrates ultimately deny that a generally accepted God is a God. Because, see, the problem is, Eros only comes about as a relationship, as a result of human beings being split. In a certain respect, it is not divine, but it is incredibly important, at least, to the degree that he's simply describing Eros. This is simply the state of affairs. Eros will not be collectivized. It will not be. You will not be told. No government will be able to tell you. You can sleep with this. It's not going to work. You have to be attracted to this and not to that. It's not going to work. And so it's a simple fact that it's resistant, that Eros is resistant to law.
So would you say it's almost like a nuclear effect, like a nuclear force, where, you know, since we've been separated, it's like the nuclear atom finding its other half to be stable?
Right. No, it's drawing it together. To achieve, I think the way that it's basically presented in it is to achieve satisfaction, at least momentary satisfaction. You have to see that for Aristophanes sees love in the embrace, in the coming together. It's not true of Socrates. Socrates does not see. Socrates focuses on the originating principle of Eros, which is the side of the beautiful or the side of the beloved. It is the sign. That requires distance. Not if you have union, you don't have contemplation. You can only contemplate that which you are separate from. And so Socrates will emphasize that aspect of love.
I was just reading an article by Ruth Huber about the origins of lifetime monogamy.
Okay.
The coming together of the two halves over an entire lifetime, which in human history is a very rare thing. In fact, only brought about in plow-based societies. Eros would be the normal way that humans reproduce, which is a different partner every 7 years. And so you're having, if I get this right, Aristophanes is promoting lifetime monogamy versus he's claiming that Plato is more into the normal state of human affairs where love is based on eros rather than this commitment to one another for life, as in agrarian society.
No, I would be careful of that, because ultimately marriage and Aristophanes is something that's required by law.
Right, that's what law comes from, is from the agrarian society.
No, I mean, that is to say, the coming together for procreation is something that's required by law. It's not something that is intrinsically tied to Eros for Aristophanes. For Aristophanes, Eros is in the embrace, is in union, not in reproduction. That's ultimately why he is the only one in the symposium to ultimately make the case that pederasty is natural, or that is to say, that it derives from a natural order. The males, the pederasty comes from the males who are the offspring of the sun. Lesbianism comes from the offspring of the earth, the females. And then heterosexual, if you will, or procreative relationships come from the moon, those that were the descendants of the moon. Simply by stating that about pederasty, that gives you the sign that Eros cannot be tied to procreation for him.
But in a male-dominated embrace?
No, all the halves look for their whole. Look for their other half.
But wouldn't a male dominate in the embrace?
To the degree, certainly, yeah, because they are of the highest being. They are from the sun. They are the most masculine. They are the most manly, which is manliness is the translation of Andrea, the virtue, which would simply, the virtue of courage. It's typically translated as courage.
This is the first time I've heard of this particular creation scenario with these spherical beings. But there was another one called a Lemurian. And that is part of the esoteric doctrine that Lemurians preceded humans as we know them, and they were esoteric. They could move between the planets, I think. Can you relate Lemurians and give us some idea of what culture the Lemurians come from and what culture this comes from? How popular was this spherical human being concept?
In
the ancient world?
No, I think he's right. This is ridiculous. If you remember what the word ridiculous means, ridere is a Latin word for to laugh. It is ridiculous, it is laughable. This comes from a comic poet. He trades in laughter. That's the whole thing. It is. That does not mean that there is not something serious. Of course there's something serious to comedy. Because there are certain things you will not laugh at. You will not laugh at a rape. Hopefully. You will not laugh at a rape. What you will laugh at, and in some sense tells something about your principles, and of course your principles are informed by your understanding of the whole, of the world in which you live. There is something very serious to the comic art. The more interesting case would be the Bible. There was no reason. God could have easily made a woman, but he deliberately chose to take a rib and make the woman out of it. This idea of, in some sense, recognizing your other half in another. It's not something. I don't know that it's necessarily particularly culturally bound in that way. It seems to be a relatively universal thing. This sort of fateful experience of love.
Lifetime monogamy is very rare.
Lifetime monogamy is very rare.
Very rare in terms of culture. It's less than 5%.
I don't know. I plead ignorance on this. Certainly that's the whole thing. In the biblical account, after the fall, man becomes worse. in Aristophanes, as a result of man's rebellion, he becomes ultimately better. He becomes civilized. And which is definitely, Aristophanes is not a shame to civilization.
During dinner, we discussed that in January, he's going to North Carolina to join the Benedictine monastery to become a monk, our speaker, in January. 60 days. Tell us about that. Tell us about your hopes, your expectations.
I'm not given to talking about myself. Right, so I mean, ultimately, I'm a Roman Catholic, but being a Roman Catholic does not prevent me from learning, of course, from Plato. But the intention, the hope, is to join the monastery of Belmont Abbey in North Carolina to give up my life. So that's that's sort of good. It's a beautiful place if you ever, it's online. It's 15 minutes outside of Charlotte, North Carolina. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. At some point in time, I think North Carolina has the fewest number of Catholics in this. There was a point in time when the Abbey basically served as the whole diocese for North Carolina. And so there's a real splendor there. But in the end, that's it. Life history.
Are Benedictine monasteries, are there a number of them in the U.S.? I know there's one in Arkansas.
Yeah, there's one in Oklahoma, St. Gregory's. St. Gregory's University, inspired by the Benedictines. In Louisiana, there's Covington, Louisiana. There's St. Joseph Minor Seminary, inspired by the Benedictines. Indiana, St. Manum, Pennsylvania. They're relatively common. In fact, Lindsay and Munster, which are two North Texas towns, where ultimately their churches were erected under Benedict.
Anyone else have a question for Mr. Condon? Okay, please remember to pay your check. Do you have a question, Craig?
The projection of this situation with the urge to make a whole,
right,
to look to find oneself, right, and someone else. Now, is that, I assume that projects into the finding the love of one's life, all that sort of
thing. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It seemed like we didn't get to that completion, but
right.
That's more or less, this is a background for explaining the current situation.
Right. So, yeah, okay. The myth is in some sense giving voice to that experience of love. I mean, to some degree, I mean, I would imagine this is a relatively common human experience. I'm just going to die if she doesn't or if he doesn't. This drives one mad, almost. The thing is, though, the question is, if you are supposed to be one, why are you two? In some sense, you can see this in the background of the Phaedo. If the body is the tomb of the soul, or if the soul is perfected by being away from the body, why is it ever with the body to begin with? The thing is that he gives you a myth that coheres with your experience. But unfortunately, Aristophanes did not say, have I correctly understood the experience? And that's what Socrates will ultimately and will ultimately take him to task for.
Mm-hmm. The corollary question of that is why, if out-of-body beings and angels and so forth are so superior, why in so many cases do their major focus is to get into a body and possess a body, even though it may be a relatively inferior human body? They seem to get off.
Okay. Well, that would definitely be a valid question. Certainly.
It's Eros.
That is the basic difficulty, as far as I can tell, for Aristophanes' speech. As charming as it is, as complementary to human experiences as it may be, nevertheless, he bears a fundamental reality. It doesn't matter how many times you come together in an erotic relationship, in a conjugal act, it doesn't matter. Even if Hephaestus melts you together, you will still be two. You will still be two. And what is the only possibility for, that is to say, ultimately, what is being left out, what is sort of being veiled in Aristophanes' account is the soul. You would hold that as a possibility that, well, we may not be able to become one bodily, but can we become one in terms of the soul? And that is hate. But that connects Eros with death.
Lifetime monogamy is an economic necessity for the guy.
You would have to die in order for it to happen. And so, that's not a happy state of affairs either. At least from the perspective of Eros. Hades is not the Christian heaven. So, yes. Yes.
Hi. Hi. Later, Dionysius, the Apagate, would contribute.
Okay, Areopagite?
He would contribute this Eros as actually being the Christian God, you know, before the kind of rejection of Platonism came along and made it into agape. He would say that Eros was really the Christian God of, you know, the early centuries, according to Platonism. He would completely reject this, that this would be, you know, Socrates' version of the good, or would he?
Now Socrates and Aristophanes do agree that Eros is not a god.
A attribute or a projection of that good, not the Olympian god, but the good.
It will turn out in Socrates' speech that Eros is the philosopher. That Eros is the philosopher who is constantly looking, who is constantly searching for wisdom. Of course, never finds it, because then he would be wise and would not be a philosopher. Philosophers, you know, it's Socrates' speech. If you have wisdom, if you have completion, you're no longer searching. The philosopher is endeavoring to find that in a certain sense. There is no room, and there is nothing in Aristophanes' account as far as intellect, mind, reason, or achieving completion through the rational capacity, which you can guess where Socrates is going to take that. That ultimately oneness, in some sense, will the only degree that oneness can be achieved will be through the knower and the known, between the knower and the knowable object.
Gracias.